He doesn't exist.
With those words, spoken without any conscious thought or effort on his part, Luke Skywalker sat upright in bed and looked around at the dimly illuminated chamber. Beside him, his wife Mara stirred, and he glanced down at her. Who doesn't exist? I don't know. An enemy. You dreamed about him? He nodded. I've had the dream a couple of times before. It's not just a dream. It's coming to me through currents in the Force. He's all wrapped up in shadows. A dark, hooded cloak, but more than that, shadows of light and... Luke shook his head, struggling for the correct word. And ignorance, and denial. And he brings great pain to the galaxy, and to me.
Well, if he brings pain to the galaxy, you're obviously going to feel it, Mara said.
No, to me personally, in addition to his other evil. Luke sighed and laid down again. It's too vague, and when I'm awake and I try to peer into the future to find him, I can't.
Because he doesn't exist.
That's what the dream tells me. Luke hissed in aggravation.
I have an idea, Mara said.
Tell me.
Let's wait until he shows up, then crush him.
Luke smiled. All right. He closed his eyes and his breathing slowed, and within a minute, the rhythm of his breathing became that of natural sleep.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Legacy of the Force, Betrayal, by Aaron Alston, read for you by Mark Thompson.
Coruscant.
Leia Organa Solo, one-time princess of the world of Alderaan, former chief of state of the New Republic, now a Jedi Knight, stood before the portal dressed in all white robes, suitable to either a Jedi or a politician in informal surroundings. Leia's husband, Han Solo, one of the most famous men in the galaxy, moved up beside her. He was wearing his favorite clothes, dark military trousers decorated with the red Corellian blood stripes he had earned when he was a younger man, light long-sleeve shirt, black vest, practical black boots. A chime filled the air. First through the door were Luke Skywalker and Mara Jade Skywalker. For this occasion, Luke wore his black Jedi robe and accoutrements, a stark contrast to his still fair complexion and bright blonde hair. Mara wore more traditional Jedi robes in browns and tans, and a red belt that set off her red hair. With them was R2-D2. The plug-shaped astromech who had variously served Luke and the Solos for decades, and the little droid made as many musical, wheedling noises of appreciation during their tour of the Solos' new quarters as the humans made verbal comments. Next to arrive, just a few minutes later, were Jason and Ben, led from room to room by C-3PO. Jason made noncommittal noises about the antechamber, living chamber, master bedroom, bedrooms for Leia's Nogri bodyguards, Meewal and Cockmame, guest bedrooms, library, refreshers, furnished balcony, kitchen, dining room, and communication center, all but the last decorated and furnished in warm-colored hardwoods, some with dark carpets and some with pebbled flooring. In the living chamber, C-3PO, the gold-toned protocol droid who had served Han and Leia faithfully, if fussily, for 4 decades, held out his carefully arrayed tray of geometrically shaped cheeses and fungus crackers to Mara.
Jaina just called in. She and Zek are just a few minutes out, Leia said.
Han straightened irritably on the couch. And Zek? Who may I ask invited Zek? He's not family.
Luke and Mara managed to say, not yet, simultaneously. Han glared at them.
I invited him, Leia said. Han, he's her partner, her Jedi partner. If he were her, say, smuggling partner, would you send him off?
Depends on how he looks at her.
Leia shook her head.
Jaina says they're friends, just friends.
The door chime rang again. This time it was Jaina and Zek. Jaina, too, was in standard Jedi robes.
She was of about the same height as her mother and more slender of build, with dark eyes and delicate features. Zack, her partner, was in his late 20s, slightly younger than Jaina, but was otherwise her opposite in almost every way. Tall enough for his scalp to scrape the top of the doorway as he entered, his long black hair pulled back in a ponytail, he would stand out in any crowd regardless of the cut and color of his traveler's robes. The argument began over spice loaf, the traditional Karelian dish. A dense ground meat spiced to the heat tolerance of the diners was, as Leia had prepared it, both mild and savory, and was not likely to cause disagreement all by itself. It was merely the course that was on everyone's plate at the point Han decided to become argumentative. He set his fork down and looked suspiciously at his nephew Ben.
You were doing what?
Making sure they did what the government said.
The boy returned his uncle's stare, unintimidated.
Stop making weapons except for the government.
Well, that's an oversimplification, Jason said.
This Adumari company was producing explosive ordnance beyond what was permitted for delivery to the Galactic Alliance Armed Forces, or otherwise legal as per order GAO 1133B, that is, beyond the amounts necessary for their own planetary defense. In other words, they were assembling proton torpedoes and other missiles for sale to other planets, not for delivery to the GA.
So?
Han asked.
That's not business for the Jedi. That's a problem for politicians with nothing better to do. Next thing you know, we'll have Jedi walking the government halls on Corellia and telling us what to do.
Leia smiled. Han hadn't lived on Corellia for decades, but in his heart, he was all Corellian, embodying the swagger, the cockiness, the carefree attitude that the citizens of that system considered essential elements of their culture. His exploits during the rebellion and up through the present day had made him dear to the hearts of the people of that system. The second best-known Corellian hero of the same era, Wedge Antilles, did live in the Corellian system, but he was more reserved, less brash, and simply hadn't captured the public's affection as Han had.
Han, the Corellians are playing a dangerous game, Luke said. They're demanding all the advantages of Galactic Alliance membership, trade benefits, use of the GA communications and travel infrastructure, citizenship rights, all of it, but not contributing their fair share of Alliance overhead. They're dragging their heels on supplying ships and personnel to the military, on providing tax revenues.
See, that's the thing.
Han pointed his fork at Luke's chest as if intending to jam it and probe around the heart and lungs.
We can maintain our own military and not the tiny peacekeeping and police force the new laws are calling for. When the time comes for military action, the Corellians have always brought our forces up, under our own colors, even when we weren't members of whatever government was swinging the biggest stick at the time. We did it for the Old Republic and the New Republic. We did it in the Vong War.
Jaina grimaced.
Not a good example, Dad. How many lives, how many whole systems were lost in the Vong War because governments couldn't work together, didn't have standardized weapons, communications, tactics?
Han turned his scowl on his daughter.
How many lives, how many whole systems were lost because the New Republic government was so bloated, impersonal, and stupid that it couldn't see when it was getting its rear end kicked and didn't care when millions of its people got killed? How many members of Borsk's old advisory council ran off to their homeworlds with personal yachts packed with treasure and left people behind to burn?
Which is exactly what Corellia is doing, Luke said. They're trying to pack up their treasures and avoid the economic toll that rebuilding civilization is taking on the rest of the Galactic Alliance, while they're throwing up a shield of planetary pride to convince people that their decision is based on something other than selfishness and irresponsibility. And other systems are starting to look to Corellia in a leadership role. It's foolish to cast the Galactic Alliance as the Empire and Corellia as the Rebel Alliance, because that's what it might come to, a rebellion, a stupid and unnecessary one.
Luke, Mara said. Her voice was a whispered note of caution.
Is that the position of the Jedi Order?
Han asked, voice rising.
What the galaxy needs is one language, one system of measurement, one uniform, one flag. Should we just cut the word no out of the language and substitute yes, sir, right away, sir, instead?
Han, Leia said. Not nice to argue in front of a guest.
Zek's not a guest. He's the man chasing my daughter all over the galaxy.
Dad...
I think...
Han paused and looked around the table, finally aware of all the eyes on him. He plunged his fork into the last piece of spice loaf on his plate and hurriedly swallowed the piece of meat.
I think I'm done. I think I'm going to wash some dishes.
Jason, Leia, and Mara relaxed on the living chamber furniture. In the kitchen, Han, maintaining his self-imposed exile, was riding roughshod over C-3PO in the act of cleaning the dinnerware. Luke was alone in the sealed-off communications room, borrowing the Solo's comm gear for some sort of official Jedi business call. Ben and R2-D2 were out on the balcony, matched in a musically noisy but bloodless hologame. Jaina and Zek were out there too, but they were at the railing side of the balcony, watching the endless streams of multicolored traffic flow by in the nighttime sky.
Ben, Mara said, is more open, more trusting.
Her words, directed at Jason, were as much question as statement. Jason nodded, thoughtful, and took a sip from his wine glass.
I think he is. He's coming to understand the Force and people. The fact that he's inherently a bit suspicious of both of them is working in his favor. He's progressing slowly and cautiously. He's not as likely to give in to temptations of the dark side of the Force, or even to teenage hormone rushes.
As a small child during the tragic Yuuzhan Vong War, Ben had become fearful and suspicious of the Force, retreating from it despite his own inherited facility with it. Only as Jason's unofficial apprentice had he begun to overcome the emotional damage of that time. Mara shuddered.
Don't bring up the specter of teenage hormone rushes.
Leia snorted. Not ready to become a grandmother yet?
I think I'd throw myself on my lightsaber first.
Jason? Luke stepped into the main living area from the hallway leading to the communications chamber. Care to take a walk with me?
Of course.
Jason rose. A dim side corridor led them away from the main access corridor toward an oversized door that occasionally vibrated. Beyond it, though muted, was the hum and roar of Coruscant nighttime traffic. The door lifted out of the way as they approached, revealing a swirl of colors outside, the running lights of flying vehicles, from two-person speeders to small, lumbering freighters, hurtling by outside, a high, aerial traffic lane that passed mere meters from the pedestrian balcony outside the door. This balcony ran the length of Han and Leia's building along a canyon-like drop. Luke gestured to the left, where the walkway rose in a series of short steps some 5 meters across a distance of 50, and they began walking in that direction.
Your father surprised me, Luke said, with his mention of Jedi walking the government halls in Corellia.
Surprised you? Jason thought about it. Not because he's being paranoid, because he's not being paranoid. Because there are plans along those lines.
Luke nodded, his expression glum.
Jason continued. It seems like an extreme action. Has the GA given up on negotiation with Corellia?
The GA is aware of some facts that haven't made it to the Holocom news feeds, Luke said. What I'm about to tell you is for your ears alone.
Understood.
The Corellian government, or someone inside it, appears to be constructing a planetary assault fleet in secret.
Jason frowned. For use against whom?
That's a good question, and it's a question military intelligence hasn't been able to answer yet.
Why'd you say the Corellian government or someone inside it? Do we not know who's responsible?
Luke shook his head.
The truth is, this intelligence is based primarily on analyses of procurement patterns, plus a long history of suspicious personnel assignments.
Wait. The existence of the fleet is based on the reports of accountants?
Luke grinned. What do you have against accountants?
Nothing, I guess.
The problem with the data we have, though, is that it gives us no idea where they're building the fleet, only that it's been under construction for almost a decade, and our logistics people think it's nearing completion.
Jason grew thoughtful for a moment, then asked,
And you want me to find the shipyards and confirm the intelligence?
Luke shook his head.
I wish it were that easy. Admiral Pellion is confident that military intelligence will soon pinpoint the base. We need you to handle a more pressing matter.
More pressing than a planetary assault?
Yes.
Luke took a deep breath.
The Corellian government is close to making Center Point Station operational again.
That stopped Jason where he stood. He stared at Luke, his surprise earning him a nod of affirmation from his uncle.
Centerpoint Station was a relic, an artifact of an ancient civilization that had, in a sense, constructed the Corellian star system by dragging several inhabitable planets to the system and sending them into beneficial orbits. Several hundred kilometers in diameter, it had, over the centuries, been the object of internal and external attempts at control,
by political and military forces that had never quite learned how to utilize it. At the heart of Centerpoint Station was an apparatus that could focus gravity and move planets or even affect the orbits of stars. It could move them, it could affect them. Used more aggressively, it could destroy them. At times, the Corellians and others had been close to being able to utilize this as a reliable, devastating weapon. But it had for years been restricted by biometric data to operation by only one person, Anakin Solo. The last time it had been used was during the Yuuzhan Vong War. After years of being essentially non-functional, it had been brought to operability by the simple realization that it had imprinted on Anakin Solo and could be activated only by him. Jason had argued that it should not be used against the Yuuzhan Vong or anyone. It was too terrible, too unpredictable a weapon. Anakin Solo had argued for it, his reasoning being that its use could prevent the Yuuzhan Vong from destroying millions of lives. Anakin had activated it. Thrakken Sal Solo had fired it. Its use hadn't gone well. It had destroyed much of the mighty warfleet of the Hapes Cluster, one of the New Republic's allies. Later in the war, of course, Anakin had died, apparently eliminating the likelihood of it ever being used again.
"Have they made it operational?" Jason asked.
Luke shrugged. "The information we have suggests that they've figured out how to duplicate crucial elements of Anakin's biometrics, probably handprint, retinal patterns, and brainwaves in the absence of surviving tissues, to pull it off."
"And the GA's afraid the Corellians will actually use it as a weapon against them?" Jason asked.
"Not directly, not at first. But if the Corellians use their new fleet to launch an assault against some system, they could then keep the GA at bay with the threat that Centerpoint Station poses. And even if this theoretical sneak attack turns out not to be their plan, Chief Omis is concerned that if the GA continues to enforce its current mandates, the Corellians would be able to use the station to preserve their independence, their autonomy." Jason let his mind drift for a moment into the future, into one possible future, one most likely to result from the actions Luke was describing, and caught just a vision of vast fleets at war, of planetary surfaces suffering bombardment, of brother and sister firing on each other. The brief glimpse turned his stomach. "So the Galactic Alliance is calling on the Jedi Order?" Luke nodded. "More specifically, Admiral Pellion sees outright rebellion across many star systems as a direct consequence of continued inaction by the GA. Several of his computer-modeled outcomes point that way, as apparently his instinct does. Other admirals he's consulted agree, and so Kyle Omis has signed off on this plan." Jason took a deep breath, considering. "So what's the plan?" Luke circled in around his answer. "Among the scientists and support crew who have been studying Centerpoint Station for Corellia, there are GA spies, of course. They would have a very hard time smuggling in squadrons of elite soldiers to damage or disable the facility. One or two infiltrators they could manage, and packing squadrons worth of effectiveness into one or two people means Jedi."
"Yes."
"What do you want me to do?"
"Travel to Centerpoint Station and disable or destroy it. Will you do it?"
"Yes, of course. But why me?"
"A few reasons. First, unlike most Jedi, you've been there. Second, because of who raised you. You can put on an authentic Corellian accent when you want to. Third, your specialized training in alternative philosophies of the Force makes you more versatile than many other Jedi. Than some Jedi Masters, in fact. Making it harder to stop you."
"And what about Ben?"
Luke was silent for a long moment.
"That is a matter for you, as his teacher, to decide."
Even on dangerous missions, Jedi Masters often took their apprentices. It was how those apprentices learned. Sometimes the apprentices died with their teachers, and Luke had considered the question of whether Jason should take Luke's own son and put the decision entirely on Jason's shoulders. Luke had responded as a Jedi Master should, not letting his relationship with the apprentice in question cloud his judgment. Jason would have to do the same.
"He'll come with me."
Luke nodded,
apparently serene in his acceptance of Jason's decision.
2 days after the Solo Skywalker family dinner, Han Solo sat on one of his living chamber sofas, a portable terminal in his lap, scowling at the display screen. Leia materialized behind him, leaning over his shoulder, and read aloud the text on the screen.
"Operation failed. You may be using connection information that is out of date.
Trying to straighten out your taxes?
Very funny.
Han didn't sound amused. Do you remember Wildis Jiklip?
Leia frowned. Wildis Jiklip was a mathematics prodigy about Han's age. Well-traveled, with a Corellian mother and a Coruscanti father, she had been educated in both systems and had been licensed to teach at the university or academy level by the time she was in her early 20s. Leia nodded.
Sure. What about her?
She's supposed to be on Coruscant doing one of her lecture series. I tried to get in touch with her to talk about Corellia. I thought maybe she could give me a hint about the official GA reaction to what's going on there. But she discontinued her lecture series in the middle just a few days ago, and all the ways I have to get in touch with her are out of operation, reporting that she's on leave of absence due to a family emergency.
Leia shrugged. So?
Well, she has no family. Yeah, I know, that's not suspicious in and of itself, but I still wanted to talk political shop with other Corellians, so I arranged for a holotransmission to Wedge Antilles.
And how is Wedge?
Well, I couldn't get through to him via holonet. They say there's some sort of equipment breakdown causing intermittent connections with the Corellian system.
So you sent him a message by standard record and transmit?
Han nodded. Just a heads up, how you doing sort of message.
And?
And it got there, and I got a reply.
But it was delayed by several hours. Long enough for my message and the reply to have been intercepted, decrypted, scanned, and analyzed before being passed on.
All right, Leia said. So communications to Corellia are under close scrutiny.
So I kept looking around. Han looked troubled. Activated some false identities. Bounced message packets to Corellia via Commodore and some other worlds. Checked with some old friends still in the trade. Found that anti-smuggling patrols by the GA are intensifying right now. In the vicinity of Corellia and a few worlds that have spoken out in support of Corellia. I'm really beginning to think something's up.
Leia moved around to the front of the couch and settled beside her husband. Something more than just mild harassment by the GA to inconvenience a system that's not playing by the rules, you mean?
Yeah, but I don't really know how to confirm it, how to take my hunch and make it into a fact.
Leia considered. As a Jedi Knight, her primary responsibilities were to the Jedi Order and the Galactic Alliance. If the Galactic Alliance was indeed planning some sort of action against Corellia, her duty was to support it. But that was only one of her loyalties. She couldn't just ignore her loyalty to Han, even if he was supporting a foolish cause.
Suddenly she grinned.
Had he ever supported a cause that, from some perspective, wasn't foolish, including the Rebel Alliance?
What's so funny?
Nothing. I was just thinking about other ways to figure out what's going on.
Such as?
She began counting off on her fingers. One, if the GA is planning some sort of action against Corellia, then a number of people in the GA government know it. Particularly self-serving ones with economic interests on Corellia are going to be doing whatever they can to protect those interests. If they're sloppy, it would be possible to spot their activities, their transactions. Two, if the action against Corellia is going to involve the military, determining which military forces are called up would be very informative. Different forces would be used for an assault or for a blockade, for instance.
Han nodded.
Good, good.
Three, we could formulate some likely plans for action against Corellia, determine the resources needed for those plans, and then attempt to determine whether those resources are actually being moved into place. That would give you some sense of what's actually going to happen, assuming that your plans are accurate ones.
Right. Han smiled. I don't care much for data work or number crunching, but it looks like I've just assigned myself a lot of it.
I'll help you, Han.
Thanks.
The Corsec officer, trim in her brown and burnt orange uniform, her face hidden behind the blast shield of a combat helmet, leapt into the doorway and raised her blaster rifle. Before it could line up against Jason, he lashed out with his lightsaber, slicing through the weapon, through the woman. She fell in two smoking pieces, making a resounding bang against the metal floor. Jason cast a quick look back the way he'd come, down endless halls packed with twisting cables and mechanical extrusions whose functions no one had been able to discern or divine even after decades of study. Somewhere back there, Ben lay, victim of a blaster shot to the chest, part of a barrage that had been too fast, too heavy for Jason to compensate for. He shook his head. He couldn't allow himself to be distracted by irrelevancies, not with the success of his mission so close. He reached out with the Force, a casual sweep that would reveal to him the presence of living beings beyond the portal, and feeling none, he stepped through.
Here it was, the control chamber for the Centerpoint Station weapon.
The room was surprisingly small, considering the incredible power it harnessed. From a pocket within his Jedi robes, Jason plucked a peculiar data chip. Unlike a standard data card, which would fit within the slot readers of the billions of data pads, computers, high-end comlinks, or vehicular control panels that were equipped to scan and utilize the memory devices, it had rounded ends and spiky protrusions of gold, allowing it to conform to exactly one known port in all the galaxy. But where was that port? He closed his eyes and probed with senses that could not be so easily fooled. And he found almost instantly what he was looking for, a slot shaped in the reverse image of the front end of his data chip. Eyes still closed, he stepped forward, extended the chip, and felt it being gripped by, then drawn into the machinery below the control board surface. He released it and opened his eyes. The chamber's thousands of indicator lights went dead, and the sounds of shouts and onrushing feet from the corridor stilled. A female voice announced,
"Simulation ended. Success ratio 75% estimated only."
Jason grinned sourly. Anything over 51% was sufficient for the success of the mission. It meant that one of the several techniques intended to damage or destroy Centerpoint Station had been initiated. But even 75% wasn't good enough. It meant that either he or Ben had fallen. 51% and both would have died. Ben moved into the doorway and carefully stepped over the bisected body of the droid wearing Corsec armor. He rubbed his chest and looked embarrassed.
"Stunbolts sting," he said.
Jason nodded. "More motivation for you not to be hit by them." The wall behind the main control board slid upward, revealing a monitoring chamber beyond. Several computer stations, one central chair with four viewing monitors mounted on spindly, adjustable bars around it. The man in the chair, stout, gray-bearded, a trifle overweight, offered the two Jedi a faint smile.
"You're getting there," he said, his voice deep, rumbling.
"This one seemed pretty easy, Dr. Sayah,"
Jason gestured around.
"One guard in the final chamber?" "Easy?" Penn sounded outraged. "They shot about 1,000 blaster bolts at us."
"Jason's right," Dr. Sayah said. "This one is easier."
Dr. Sayah pushed aside a couple of obtrusive monitors and rose from his chair.
"The problem is, we don't know what the main weapons control chamber looks like now. This is how it was 3 weeks ago when everyone but a core crew of scientists was pulled out and reassigned elsewhere. They could have replaced all the equipment with string cheese or encased the room in Duracrete. We don't know," he shrugged. "So long as you have that data chip intact, and so long as the receptacle slot is still in existence on the control board, even if you have a wobber of a time finding it, then this approach could work."
"Could work?" Jason repeated.
"We think it will. The commands in that data chip should initiate a 10-minute countdown, and then activate a complex repulsor pulse that will tear the station apart, assuming that they haven't reprogrammed their system sufficiently to overcome the programming on that chip. Assuming that my team and I did our jobs right all these years. Assuming a lot of things."
Dr. Sayah sighed. Across a span of days, Han and Leia put together facts, numbers, disappearances, reappearances, ship movements, personnel reassignments, things said and things not said, into a complex computer projection carefully maintained, though scarcely understood, by C-3PO. Fact: elements of the Galactic Alliance Second Fleet were being diverted from their missions of record. Fact: communications between Coruscant and Corellia continued to be problematic in a fashion suggesting that comm traffic was being heavily monitored and analyzed. Fact: civilian experts on Corellian government, military, and economics were increasingly unavailable. Fact: Corellian corporate properties belonging to Pfefferin Loyn, chair of the GA Finance Council, had recently been sold or traded in kind for properties in the Kuat system. These were only a representative sampling of the data Han and Leia found and loaded into C-3PO's new analysis routine. But all the facts supported Han's growing conviction that something very bad was about to happen in the planetary system where he'd grown up. His conviction wasn't eased when C-3PO, during one of their analysis sessions in the Solo's living chamber, said,
"To all appearances, Corellia is about to experience a pasting, I believe the term is."
Han snorted, an irritated noise that caused the protocol droid to lean back away from him.
Does your newfound analytical skill give you any idea as to exactly what form this pasting is going to take?
Oh, no, sir. I'd have to be loaded with extensive military planning applications, not to mention extensive databases, in order to offer you a useful prediction on that matter.
Goldilocks, go get us some calf, Han said.
Han waited until C-3PO was in the kitchen and the door closed behind him. He turned to his wife.
So what do we do to keep this from happening?
Leia drew in a breath to answer, but held it for several long moments.
Perhaps, she finally said, the best thing to do would be to not interfere.
Not do anything, he said.
Han, what happens if Corellia continues doing exactly what it's doing and gets away with it, suffers no consequences?
Corellia becomes independent again, Han shrugged. So?
And other worlds follow Corellia's lead.
Again, so?
The Alliance will be weakened. Things will become more untidy. More opportunities for crime, black markets, corruption.
For once, Han spent a few moments considering his reply.
Leia, there's gotta be room in this galaxy for independence, for chaos. In a galaxy as tidy, as sanitary, as controlled as you're talking about, I never could have happened. I'd really prefer to live in a galaxy where there's room for someone like me.
Leia looked away from him, and in her expression, Han could see the dawning of a regret that amounted to mourning.
Then the thing to do is warn Corellia, she said.
Preferably without alerting the GA that you're doing it, because it would be nice for you not to be thrown in jail.
Coronet Corellia.
Wearing only shorts and a blue undershirt, bearing the symbol of the original Rebel Alliance, in black, now fading to gray, Wedge Antilles moved to the front door of his quarters and activated the security panel on the wall beside it. The screen flickered to life and showed a man and a woman standing in the hall outside. Both were young, in their mid-20s, and despite the fact that they were in gray jumpsuits and overcoats that constituted one form of anonymous street dress on Corellia, their haircuts, military short rather than slightly shaggy, and an indefinable quality about their body language and facial expressions marked them as outsiders. Wedge glanced over his shoulder. His wife, Aiella, stood in the doorway to their bedroom. She wore a simple white robe, and her hair, normally a wavy gray-brown cascade, was a tousled mess, including one tuft protruding almost straight up. She had one hand cupped over her mouth as she yawned. The other held a full-size blaster pistol at her side. Yawn done, she gave him a questioning look, one eyebrow raised. He shrugged, then turned back to the door and activated the exterior speakers.
What is it?
The female visitor, a well-muscled blonde woman who looked to be at least as tall as Wedge, said,
General Wedge Antilles?
He moved, Wedge said. I think he's over in Zed Block. He left the carpets a mess, too.
The male visitor, a broad-shouldered, dark-haired man who looked as though he'd probably represented his military unit as wrestling champion, merely smiled. The woman continued.
I'm sorry for the late visit, General, but we really need to speak to you.
Wedge flipped on the living room lights and looked back over his shoulder again. The door was open, but Aiella was no longer in sight. She'd be hanging back in the darkness, wearing something far less visible than the white robe, the blaster in hand, just in case. Wedge pressed the switch to open the front door. It slid down and out of sight, revealing the two visitors.
Come in.
Thank you, the woman said.
The two moved in, and Wedge tripped the door just as soon as they cleared the threshold.
I apologize for waking you, the woman said. I'm Captain Barthas, with Intelligence Section. This is my associate, Lieutenant Titch.
Wedge waved the visitors toward the cream-colored stuffed furniture that lined one wall of the room.
Have a seat.
Captain Barthas gave him a little shake of the head. Actually, we've been sitting for hours, on a shuttle.
Of course. Wedge waited.
The Galactic Alliance needs your help, General, the woman said.
Wedge offered a faint snort.
Captain, the Galactic Alliance is teeming with officers who were compelled to retire after the war with the Yuuzhan Vong, for the simple reason that a peacetime military doesn't need as many of them. Some of these folks are quite brilliant, and unlike me, they're anxious to get back into uniform. You're looking for the wrong man.
No, sir, Captain Barthas shook her head in vigorous denial. The GA needs you, and your specific help.
The male visitor finally spoke, his voice softer than Wedge would have suspected.
It has to do with the events of nearly 30 years ago, when Rogue Squadron did so much work preparing for the taking of Coruscant from Imperial forces.
I see.
And it's something that requires my presence instead of a simple holocom call.
Yes, sir,
Captain Barthas said. And if you're here in the middle of the night, it's because you need me in the middle of the night.
The captain nodded, the expression on her face regretful. Wedge flipped a switch on the door side panel, and the entryway opened again.
Wait for me in the building lobby. I'll be down directly.
Now, finally, the two of them glanced at each other. Barthas said,
We'd prefer to remain here, sir.
Wedge gave her a frosty little smile.
And will you be making a holocam recording of my goodbyes with my family? Or perhaps you prefer to hug my daughter for me?
Coruscant.
Han and Leia crowded in close, side by side, so that the holocam on the terminal before them could capture both their images.
Luke,
Han said. The lights on the terminal flickered, and after a few seconds, the face of Luke Skywalker swam into view on the terminal screen. He was wearing a cold weather wrap in black with jagged decorative lines on it in subdued gray, and behind him was an anonymous white wall.
Hello.
We were wondering, Leia said, if you were planning on seeing any X-Wing action in the near future.
Her tone was light and conversational.
For the merest instant, Luke looked startled, but his features settled into an amused grin.
Why do you ask?
Well, we're planning on a vacation, Han said. In the Falcon, dashing around, seeing old friends. Me, Leia, Goldilocks, the Nogri. Do you see what I'm getting at, conversationally?
Luke's grin broadened.
I think so.
Leia and I can talk. The Nogri can keep each other occupied. But if C-3PO doesn't have R2-D2 to talk to, he'll talk to us.
Han mind putting a blaster barrel to his own temple and pulling the trigger.
Save me, Luke Skywalker. You're my only hope.
Still cheerful, Luke shook his head.
I wish I could, but Mara and I are about to do a quick training tour with a bunch of Jedi Knights anxious to learn about adapting their force-based abilities to X-Wing piloting tasks. In other words, I'm about to head out with R2.
Oh.
Han gave his brother-in-law an unhappy stare.
All right, then. Doom me to day after day of listening to dithering obsequiousness.
Nice word choice. Sorry I couldn't help with R2.
That's the way it is sometimes, Han said.
The polite smile remained fixed on his face after Luke reached forward to break the comm connection. But Han's posture failed him. He sagged into his chair as if beaten.
He's part of it, Han said.
We can't be sure.
Don't try to kid me, Leia. He was wearing a weather wrap indoors. Either he just got out of the fresher, and his hair was dry, you'll note, or he threw it on to cover over something else he was wearing, like a pilot's uniform.
You saw the wall behind him.
White, curved, a bulkhead on a vessel. He's already shipped out.
Finally, Leia nodded, reluctant. Probably. In the foremost passenger seat, Wedge sat up, startled as his shuttle came in for its landing and a familiar-looking Corellian YT-1300 leapt up past his viewport, headed for the skies.
That, he announced, was the Millennium Falcon.
If you say so, sir.
Across the aisle between seats, Captain Barthas looked dubious. There are thousands of those old Corellian transports still flying, though.
Oh, that was definitely the Falcon. I'm intimately familiar with her lines and her rust spots.
Barthas cocked her head, a whatever-you-say gesture that left no doubt in Wedge's mind that she was humoring him, and returned her attention to her datapad. Half an hour later, the two of them, Titch and a droid porter, swept into the government facility Barthas had said would be Wedge's home for the next several days at least. It was deep, within a gray pyramidal building at the edge of what had once been the Imperial Government District. The dark corridor from the turbolifts led into a large outer office laid out in rows of monitoring stations. Most of the stations were empty, their view screens unlit, but Wedge could see two that were active, both showing holocam views of long rooms with dormitory-style accommodations for four at one end and office equipment at the other. Barthas led Wedge and the others to a door, which whooshed upward and thumped into place with the speed, air displacement, and echoing sound of an armored portal. The chamber's overhead lights flickered on as they entered, revealing a room very much like those shown on the monitors. Closest to the door were four desks facing one another, laden with computer material. The far side of the room held four bunk beds and oversized equipment lockers. The porta droid moved in to drop Wedge's bags on the nearest of the bunk beds. Barthas and Titch stayed near the door and gestured at the accommodations.
A bit plain, Barthas admitted. I'm sorry.
They're luxurious compared with some of the places I've been quartered.
Wedge grabbed the rolling chair before the nearest desk, swung it around, and sat.
So, you wouldn't tell me on Corellia, you wouldn't tell me on the shuttle trip. Now, in the heart of your own secure facility, maybe you can tell me what this is all about. What am I supposed to be doing?
Barthas and Titch exchanged a look. Barthas returned her attention to Wedge.
Just, waiting, General.
Wedge blinked.
Waiting for orders?
No. Barthas looked regretful. You have no orders. Our orders are to keep you as comfortable as possible during your stay here.
Wedge refused to allow the alarm that was beginning to well up within him to show on his face.
The duration of my stay?
Barthas shrugged.
Unknown.
Its purpose?
Can't say.
Wedge closed his eyes and offered up a slow, silent sigh. Then he looked at the two of them again.
I said no, you know.
They looked confused.
When officers of the Corellian military came to me and said, there could be trouble between us and the GA, I said, sorry, fellows, I'm retired. You can get advice as useful as mine and much more up to date by looking at other Corellian officers. And so they left me alone. Why didn't you?
Barthas opened her mouth, evidently realized that she could offer no answer without somehow compromising her orders, and closed it again.
Because you see...
And this time Wedge couldn't quite keep the pain he was feeling from being reflected in his voice, as a hoarseness he could not control.
You see, that way I'd be with my family if something happened. And now, someone somewhere at the GA end of things has decided I need to be out of the way for what's going to happen, and has separated me from my family.
He fixed Barthas and Titch with his stare. Barthas actually leaned back. She shook her head.
I'm sorry, she said.
Titch seemed unaffected.
You approach this door anytime it's open, it closes, he says. Meaning, it won't do you any good to make a sudden dash for the door when we bring you food or drink. Besides, if you do make an attempt to escape, I get to kill you.
He patted the blaster pistol at his side.
This model can be set to stun or burn. I always leave it on burn.
He glanced after his partner, apparently making sure she was out of earshot. He turned back to Wedge.
Let me add this, he said. I'm sick of hearing the Rebel Alliance generation brag about how they stomped the Empire and then whine about how the galaxy owes them a living or special favors. The Empire would have kicked the Yuuzhan Vong in the teeth, and I wouldn't have lost almost everyone I knew when I was a kid if you hadn't won. Well, the higher-ups seem to think they owe you a little dignity. So here it is. Eat your meals, get in some quiet exercise, keep your mouth shut. And when all the shouting's done, you can go home and finish your self-serving memoirs about how you single-handedly won half a dozen wars. That's the deal. Got it?
Wedge studied him.
If you'd been a little smarter, I might have left you some shred of a career when I leave here. But I won't. You'll be cleaning refreshers for the rest of your life.
Outer space, near the Corellian system.
A few light years from the star Corell, a vessel dropped out of hyperspace, winking back into existence in the physical universe. It was the Galactic Alliance space vessel Dodona. On the bridge, on the broad walkway that looked over technicians' pits and stations, Admiral Matra Kloskin, commander of Dodona and leader of this operation, stood staring out through the high viewports into space. In his peripheral vision, to starboard, another vessel of war, one of the Mon Calamari star cruisers with hull designs that suggested a successful blend of technology and organic design, popped into existence. Over the next several hours, many elements of the Galactic Alliance's second fleet would be arriving here to form up with Dodona. Once everything was in position, Kloskin would give the word and send this operation into motion.
Coronet Corellia.
The diminutive woman was dressed in the flowing gowns and profanely costly jewelry strands of a noblewoman of the Hates Consortium. A semi-transparent veil concealed the lower half of her face. Her bodyguard stood in contrast to her in every way possible. Tall, primitive, and brutal of appearance, he wore the dusty robes and carried the crude blaster rifle of one of the Tusken Raiders, the sand people of rural Tatooine. His features were concealed behind the dust-storm-resistant mask that such beings usually wore in their own environment. Five-World Prime Minister Adel Saxon watched the two of them enter the hotel suite's outer chamber. Saxon, a handsome, black-haired woman of middle years, wielded considerable political power, but in the company she was about to receive, she did not feel it a political advantage. She was, as such things could be measured, the peer of her guests,
and it was in recognition of that comparative equality she'd agreed to meet them here, in this relatively ill-protected hotel, away from the prying eyes of others. Saxon waited until the outer and inner doors had shut behind her two visitors, then rose from the spindly decorative chair that served temporarily as her seat of power. She offered her visitors a nod.
"Welcome to Coronet."
"Thank you," the woman replied. She reached up to unhook one side of her veil, letting it drop away from her face, the face of Leia Organa Solo. The presumed Tusken Raider, less graceful or delicate of motion than his companion, pulled the sand mask from his face and tossed back his hood, revealing the craggy, somewhat flushed features of Han Solo.
"Yes, thank you, Your,
Excellency," Leia supplied.
"Right, Excellency."
"Please, come with me."
Saxon led her visitors into an adjacent chamber, a windowless dining room by the look of it.
"I'll get right to the point," Han said. "I believe that the Galactic Alliance is going to take military action against Corellia within the week, maybe within the day."
"Why would they?"
Saxon asked, keeping her voice controlled, impersonal.
"Negotiations between us and Coruscant are still cordial, still in developing stages."
Han shrugged.
"I don't know why, just that they are. There are political, financial, military movements going on that all point to action here, and soon."
Saxon considered. Could the Galactic Alliance have finally uncovered the Kira shipyards? It seemed unlikely. She had been Prime Minister a full year before her budget auditors discovered that the secret appropriations authorized by Thrakken Sal Solo and his political allies were being used to build a secret assault fleet. It seemed more likely that the GA's premature action had been prompted by the reactivation of Centerpoint. Saxon asked,
"And why are you telling me this?"
"Well, let's just say it galls me," Han said. "If Corellia wants to be independent, I'm all for it."
"Would you be willing to say that publicly?" Saxon asked. "In speeches to the Corellian people?"
"Sure," Han said. "If you resign as Prime Minister and Thrakken resigns as Corellian Chief of State."
"I should resign? Why?"
"I don't like the game you're playing," Han said. "Whining independence out one corner of your mouth and benefits out the other."
"That's just strategy," Saxon assured him.
"No, it isn't. Not when a lot of people are listening to you and agreeing. People who don't have the time or energy or brains to think it through."
Saxon turned to Leia.
"And what about you? You're a Jedi Knight. The Jedi are sworn to defend the Galactic Alliance. In coming here, aren't you committing treason?"
Leia blinked at her.
"How's that again?" "Your husband wants me to commit to a politically dangerous position, and yet here you are, straddling two positions too. I think perhaps you and your husband should stay here in Corellia and lend us your support. It would be safer for you. If Coruscant learned you'd come here on your errand, it could do irreversible damage to your reputation."
Leia smiled, showing teeth.
"I am a Jedi Knight, and I am sworn to defend the Galactic Alliance, even from itself sometimes. But coming here with my husband and listening to him speculate on the future of political relations isn't treason. It's just something you do when you're married."
"Speculate?"
Leia nodded.
"Speculate."
"Outer space, Corellia trade spine, passing Yagdol."
The passenger seating compartment was not ideal. It was in fact a cargo container, the sort used to transport bulk goods from one port to another. But it had been fitted with reclinable seats from decommissioned passenger shuttles. Every row was a different color, and some of the seats smelled bad. Jaina's smelled bad. If she'd been in a self-destructively contemplative mood, she might have speculated that at some time in the distant past, it had been occupied by a Hutt with a digestive disorder. Jaina was dressed in a fashion that would have let her fit in with her father's old friends. Tight-fitting trousers and a vest of black bantha leather, a red silk shirt with flowing sleeves and a matching hair scarf, a blaster holster on her belt. Half her face bore an artificial tattoo, a red flower on her cheek with green leafy tendrils spreading across her jaw and up to her forehead, and her hair was blonde, a temporary dye job. Next to her, Zek, eyes closed in sleep, wore a preposterous tan jacket of fringed leather. Beneath it was a bandolier holding 8 vibroblades. 2 false scars marked his face, one a horizontal gash across his forehead, the other down from the forehead to the right cheek. An eye patch with a blinking red diode covered that eye. Zek's eyes opened.
"Are we on Corellia yet?"
His voice was pitched as a whisper. Jaina shook her head. Not for several hours. His eyes closed, then they reopened.
Are we on Corellia yet?
Despite herself, Jaina grinned.
Why don't you go play outside for a while?
Coruscant.
There was a lot of open floor space between the office and dormitory portions of the room, and Wedge made use of it, taking his rolling chair there and playing a new game. Sitting facing one wall, he would suddenly stand, propelling his chair backward with his knees, and then turn to see how close he'd come to placing the chair near a mark he'd made on the floor. At exact six-hour intervals, Titch came in with Wedge's meals. When at the office desks, Wedge habitually sat at one of the closest to the outer door, with his back to the door. He thought of it as the number one desk. Every six standard hours, morning, noon, and evening, Titch brought Wedge's food and drink to the next desk to the left, the one Wedge thought of as number two desk, and then set the meal down there. The first time Titch entered while Wedge was playing his rolling chair game, Titch paid him no special attention. This was exactly what Wedge expected. Titch, Barthas, and possibly more security officers had to be watching his activities on hidden holocams, and so were already aware of Wedge's new preoccupation. 6 hours later, minutes before the evening meal was due to arrive, Wedge sat at his usual desk, the terminal alive before him. Of course, it didn't give him access to the worldwide data net. That would defeat the purpose of his captivity. But it did apparently sample the data net once or twice a day, allowing Wedge to follow Coruscant and Galactic News, and offered a wide variety of 30-year-old games and battle simulation programs. The little cron at the top right of the terminal screen told him that he had 5 minutes to wait before his next meal would arrive. He took a sip from his tumbler of water, untouched from his noon meal. It was still almost full. Slowly, his attention still apparently full on the battle simulation before him, he lowered the hand with that tumbler to his lap. He positioned it under the lip of the desk until it was beneath desk number two, and then, with excruciating silent care, poured most of the water out onto the floor there. It broadened as a slowly spreading, all but invisible pool. 3 minutes left. He couldn't cut things too close. Wedge typed in the next turn's series of commands to the simulation program and leaned forward to watch the turn's results. While locked in that pose, he groped around carefully under the desk and located the power cable that ran from the system's main processor up to the monitors around the desk. 2 minutes left. With his free hand, he powered down the terminal. Then with his other hand, he pulled the power cable loose and drew it to him, gathering all the slack he could obtain. Only then did he lean back in his chair. The door behind him slid open. Titch entered. Wedge recognized him by the sound of his heavy, confident stride, and asked,
"Not going so well, is it?"
Then the man moved into view, Wedge's meal in his hands, and walked up to desk number two. He set the tray down. For a brief moment, he looked confused as his fingers contacted water on the desktop. Wedge powered up his monitor and tossed the power cable onto desk number two. Titch jerked and began to shake, trapped in the spasms of electrocution. The overhead lights dimmed. Wedge stood quickly, propelling his rolling chair back and away from him. He glanced behind him. The chair came to a halt a handspan from where he'd aimed it, dead in the center of the open doorway. Then the lights went out. Wedge heard a gasp from Titch, a metallic thud as the man hit the floor. This was followed within half a second with a whoosh as the depowered door slid down and slammed into Wedge's rolling chair. Wedge located Titch by touch. The man moved feebly. Wedge found his belt, removed the blaster from its holster, and switched it from its burn setting to its stun setting. He said two words.
"Remember, refreshers."
Corellian system, outbound from planet Talus.
The shuttle was not elegant. It was just an oblong mass with thrusters and hyperdrive at one end, a viewported bridge at the other, and plenty of room for passengers in between. But in the passenger compartment, the seats were well spaced and well padded. In the back of each one was a monitor allowing the passenger behind to watch Corellian news or entertainment holocasts, or to see what the holocams spaced around the shuttle's exterior were viewing. Dr. Sayah kept his monitor switched to the bow view. In it, he could watch, as he always did, Centerpoint Station first appear, then grow larger and larger and larger. Sayah wore a plastic shirt. It was comfortable enough that it didn't always feel plastic, but plastic it was, and embedded with circuitry. Just now it was orange, with violent purple flames crisscrossing it,
a design suited to someone wandering around in a warm and sandy vacation paradise, which was precisely what Dr. Sayah's documentation said he'd been doing for the last few weeks. But the thing about the shirt, sold to wealthy tourists, was that whenever it was poked with sufficient energy, it would make an audible boop noise and change both color and design. The little human boy in the next seat, dark-skinned like his mother and perhaps 3 standard years of age, had discovered this when he kicked Dr. Sayah minutes after they'd taken off from Talus. He'd been persuaded by his apologetic mother not to kick Dr. Sayah anymore, but couldn't be restrained from reaching over and poking the scientist's spy, causing the shirt to make its pleasing boop noise and change its color scheme. Now his shirt was pink, with frothy clouds on his shoulder and upper chest, recreational sea speeders skimming across red waters at his waist. Now his shirt was deep blue, with a stylized rancor rearing up the front, arms outstretched. The little boy chuckled. Dr. Sayah looked over at the boy's mother.
Will you two be debarking at the station?
She nodded.
I'm a cartographer, a member of the station mapping project, Larisa Plur.
On the monitor screen, the stars twisted and elongated. Of course, they didn't in reality, but that was the visual effect of entering hyperspace. The ship left hyperspace almost as quickly, the duration of the greater-than-light-speed portion of this flight mere seconds, and when stars were returned to normal in precisely the same positions as before, Centerpoint Station occupied the center of the monitor screen. The station wasn't pretty, wasn't even elegant like the Death Star's, whose size it exceeded. A gray-white blob with axial cylinders protruding at 2 opposed points. It was merely impressive in its scale and in the potential damage it could do. Home to Dr. Sayah was an ugly spot in space. Dr. Sayah tugged at his shirt collar, and as he did so, he squeezed a chip embedded there. The pressure activated the chip, causing it to transmit a single-coded pulse on a single frequency. The transmission lasted a few thousandths of a second. This time, the shirt changed without the boy poking it. It was the shirt's acknowledgement that it had received a counter-transmission. Dr. Sayah settled in to watch the station grow larger on his monitor and to compose himself for the struggle and perhaps tragedy that was to come. In the shuttle's cargo hold, in a cargo container the size of an average ground speeder, Jason Solo was awakened by a melodious alarm chime. His eyes flickered open. There wasn't much to see. The interior of the compartment was dimly lit by the device to the left of his head, a combination computer and life support system. He glanced over at the computer monitor screen. Text there indicated that Dr. Sayah had just transmitted that they had completed their final hyperspace jump before arriving at Centerpoint Station. He reached up to the right of his head and found the suit helmet waiting there. He pulled it into place over his head and twisted it against his collar until it locked. Only then did he reach down to the latch beside his waist and trip it. The top of the cargo box lifted away from him, revealing a dimly lit cargo hold roof only a couple meters above him. Awkward in the enviro suit, Jason struggled into an upright position, dragged his atmosphere bottles to lock them into place against his back, and clambered out of the box. Slowly, clumsily, Jason finished climbing down from his cargo stack and observed that Ben was beginning his own descent.
Coronet Corellia.
The conveyance, a 10-meter-long airspeeder that seemed to be mostly windows and standing room, deposited Jaina and half her team on the street outside the Prime Minister's official residence. Jaina took a deep breath and looked around, wary for signs of too much attention being directed their way. There shouldn't be any. After having made planetfall hours ago, she and her team had time to check into a hostel, clean themselves up, sleep, and eliminate disguise elements that would cause them to stand out. Jaina now wore a cumbersome Kaminoian traveler's robe. Her hair was back to its natural dark color. Her false tattoo was gone.
I miss the tattoo, Zek said.
He was now dressed in Corellian common citizen's garments. His long black hair hung in a braid. The broad multi-lane avenue before her was thick with groundspeeder traffic. The huge gated building behind them was, by contrast, inert, some parts of its grounds in deep shadow from trees and creeping vines. Even the guards at the sidewalk gates and main doors were still. The other two members of their team, female Bothan Kalir Hulya and male Falin Than Mithrik, moved up to join them. Kalir, the youngest member of the team, having completed her trials and achieved Jedi Knight status only weeks before, wore an abbreviated dress in white that contrasted nicely with her tan fur and would not overheat her on this warm day. Than, dressed in a traveler's robe, looked the most Jedi-like of the four of them, but was still thoroughly unremarkable of appearance in this cosmopolitan city. He had his hood up over his long black topknot and was maintaining his skin color at a light orange, making him virtually indistinguishable from a human.
"I don't see any problems,"
Kallir said. Not that reassuring, coming from someone who'd been an apprentice a few days ago, Jaina reflected. She heard Zek snicker. Kallir looked curiously at him, but Jaina said, "Transmit that we're on station."
Outer space, near the Corellian system.
Luke, dressed in what looked like standard brown and tan Jedi gear, but which actually had all the equipment and functionality of a pilot suit, sat on the rolling staircase that was meant to give a pilot or mechanic access to the X-Wing's top surfaces. It wouldn't be needed for that purpose. The mechanics were finished for now with his XJ-6 X-Wing, and Luke wouldn't need any assistance in getting to the cockpit. For a Jedi, it was just one quick leap away. The bay where his squadron's X-Wings waited was frantic with activity. A broad expanse, all scuffed and burned permacrete flooring and pristine glow-white ceiling. It was the size of a sports arena, with room for Luke's squadron, a squad of E-5 interceptors, two squads of shield-equipped TIEs from the Imperial Remnant, and half a squad of B-Wings for support. One X-Wing over, Mara, similarly garbed, made some final ratcheting motions with her Hydro Spanner, finishing adjustments to her laser cannon positioning, and slapped closed an access panel on her craft's S-foil underside. She dropped the Hydro Spanner in a toolbox and moved over to join her husband. "Any word about Ben?" Luke shook his head. "You're very quiet." Mara leaned over to stroke his forehead. "Is everything all right?" "I meditated earlier," he said, "and I had a vision of Ben talking to the man who doesn't exist." "Not a dream," Mara said. "A vision." He nodded. "Could you tell when?" "The future." Ben was a little older, a little taller. "At least," she said, "that argues well for what he's up to today."
"Master Skywalker."
The voice, female, emerged from the vicinity of Luke's chest. He reached under his robe and pulled out a comlink. "Skywalker here."
"Bridge here. Team Perella reports on station."
"Thank you." He put the comlink away. "Jaina is ready, and that's one more check on the checklist to start this operation." Luke glanced around the pilots of his squadron. Some were talking with one another. Three were stretched out in the shadows of their X-Wings, sleeping. Two sat cross-legged, meditating. He nodded in approval at this calmness in the eye of the storm.
"Master Skywalker, Team Minock reports in position."
Luke almost sagged with relief. The lack of any sort of complications notification meant that Ben, Jason, and Dr. Sayah were aboard Centerpoint Station and standing by. Then over the hangar speakers came a different voice, male, that of Dodonna's flight control officer.
"All pilots to their craft. Group enters hyperspace in 5 minutes. All pilots to their craft."
Luke looked around at his pilots. "Hardpoint squadron, mount up."
Coronet, Corellia.
Kallir gestured down the avenue, then glanced at the chrono embedded at the snap closure of her bag.
"Right on time,"
she said. The other Jedi turned to look. In the middle distance, approaching at a high rate of speed, even for Corellian drivers, was a convoy of closed canopy airspeeders. The two in front and two in back were Corsec vehicles painted in brown and burnt orange, and warning lights of the same color flashed atop their forward viewports. The middle vehicle was a somber crimson, its viewports tinted to prevent those outside from viewing whoever might be inside. "Jedi," Jaina said. "Meet Idel Saxon, Prime Minister of the Five Worlds. Idel, meet your captors." The convoy, floating in from above the fluid streams of groundspeeder traffic, merged with the incoming stream and slowed to the groundspeeder travel rate as it neared the Jedi.
"Just like we practiced it," Jaina said. "3, 2, 1,
now." In unison, the four Jedi leapt up and over the cross traffic, each arcing toward one of the speeders in the convoy. Jaina whipped off her traveler's robe as she leapt, leaving her dressed in a close-fitting black jumpsuit. Her lightsaber was at her belt when the robe flew away, in her hand before she cleared the lane of cross-traffic groundspeeders, and lit as she came down on the forward portion of the lead Corsec vehicle. She plunged its glowing blade into the metal surface beneath her and wrenched it around, cutting through the vehicle's engine compartment. There was a pop, and the speeder immediately began to lose speed and altitude. All four Corsec speeders were now shrilling an alarm, a high-pitched, rapid-pulse tone that hammered Jaina's ears and told Corellians for a kilometer around that there was trouble. Jaina felt the blow as the speeder she rode hit the avenue, but the pilot was good, retaining control. The speeder bumped once, hard, slewed to port, slewed to starboard, and came to a skidding shower of sparks stop not far from the Prime Minister's residence gates. Then she felt the pulse of shock and alarm from Zek. Zek came down atop the Prime Minister's speeder and drove his lightsaber into the canopy over the passenger compartment. It was a shallow thrust, followed by the traditional circular swirl, and it was a slow maneuver. The air speeder was heavily armored, and from the instant Zek landed, it began a series of swerves and climb-and-dive bucking maneuvers, all designed to throw him free. He just grinned, relying on the Force to keep him rooted firmly in place. The airspeeder was upside down and 50 meters above the avenue when Zek finished transcribing his circle with the lightsaber. The impromptu hatch he'd cut fell past him. He leaned upward, the awkward position and angle pulling muscles like an abdomen-firming exercise, and stuck his head into the passenger compartment to confront his quarry. "Madam Minister," he said, He wasn't looking at the Five-World Prime Minister. The only individuals in the passenger compartment were droids. A skeletal figure with a Corsec uniform loosely fitted to it was in the forward position, piloting. And in the spacious crimson velour-lined main compartment sat a battered old protocol droid wearing a cumbersome ball gown and matching wide-brimmed hat of blue velvet. It held a rectangular object that looked like a double-thick portable computer terminal in closed position. On the top surface was a blinking red light.
"I have been instructed to play this for any unexpected visitors."
Then it pressed the button. Zek straightened, yanking his head and shoulders free of the hole, and leapt clear, straight down. He was a bare 2 meters from the inverted airspeeder when it exploded. Kaleer and Van, riding their respective crippled Corsec vehicles to shuddery sliding stops on the avenue, heard the boom and looked up. The reddish flash of the explosion was enough to blind Than for a moment. He threw his free arm over his eyes and concentrated on maintaining his balance. Kaleer didn't look at the explosion straight on. She saw chunks of disintegrated airspeeder flying out of the explosion cloud, and to the lower left, Zek, limp, on fire, plummeting. She raised her hand, an instinctive gesture, and exerted herself through the motion, feeling the Force swell from her, feeling it intermix with the unique set of sensations and memories and textures that were Zek. She focused entirely on the task at hand, abandoning the attention she had been paying to the Force-based adhesion that kept her feet firmly planted on the slewing, skidding airspeeder beneath them, on the lit lightsaber in her hand, or on the honking, beeping, screeching groundspeeder traffic roaring toward her and veering aside at the last second. She found Zek and slowed his descent. Now he was 15 meters above the pavement outside the Prime Minister's residence. His back was still on fire, and smoke curled up from his shoulders. Then Kaleer's airspeeder hit the rear of Jaina's downed airspeeder. Kaleer catapulted forward, smashed into the rear of that vehicle's passenger compartment, ricocheted off at an angle, hit the pavement of the avenue itself, and rolled a dozen meters before coming to a halt, bloody and unconscious. Jaina's eyes cleared from the explosion afterimage in time for her to see Zek suspended in the air not far from her, and Zek suddenly plummeting again. She leapt free of her airspeeder, hurtling between oncoming speeders in the next lane, and landed on the sidewalk outside the residence. Drawing on the Force with more speed and confidence than Kaleer could have ever employed, she caught Zek 5 meters off the ground, lowering him quickly but safely to the walk beside her. She slapped at the flames dancing across his back, smothering them. Through the Force, she could feel life pulsing strongly within him. The doors of the airspeeder she'd ridden and down whooshed open, and its two passengers stepped out. They weren't Corsec agents. They were tall and angular, their skins gleaming and metallic. Brandishing oversized blaster rifles, they advanced on Jaina's position with a confidence born of aggression programming and a lack of concern for their own welfare. They were YVH droids, Yuuzhan Vong Hunters, produced by Tendrondo Arms during the Yuuzhan Vong War, designed to match those fearsome alien warriors in deadliness and determination. "We," Jaina said, "are in trouble."
Outer Space Carrier Dodona.
Lysa Dunter sat cursing her bangs and waiting for launch. A pretty blue-eyed young woman with dark blonde hair, she never lacked for attention,
but got slightly more when she kept her hair in a shortcut with bangs. But if she didn't sweep her hair back absolutely correctly in the split second before donning her flight helmet, her bangs would drift down again and hover at the top of her peripheral vision, as they did now. She could take her helmet off in a cramped Eta 5 interceptor cockpit and try to adjust things, but if her squadron commander, whose interceptor rested on the Dodonis starfighter hangar floor one row up and just to the left of hers, were to see her do it, he'd mock her. Lysa didn't like being mocked. Her speakers popped, then she heard her squadron commander.
V-Sword lead to pilots, report status.
The commander's wingwoman immediately replied.
V-Sword 2, tip-top, ready to go.
Lysa's breathing grew faster. They were right on the verge of it, her first combat launch. She heard the pilot before her in sequence complete his acknowledgement.
V-7.
Lysa said when it was her turn. 2 green, weapons lit. Moments later, once the last of the 10 pilots had reported in, the squad leader said,
V-Sword 7, we're hearing a strange vibration over your comm.
Guiltily, Lysa froze her right leg in place, willing it to keep from bouncing.
Sorry, sir, she said. Had to dog down a loose rocker arm.
You sure it wasn't a rocker leg, 7?
The squad leader's voice sounded amused. Lysa closed her eyes and bit back a curse. Then a new voice.
Hyperspace jump complete. All squadrons, prepare to launch. Hardpoint squadron. Shuttle Trandrilla Skies. First in queue.
Straight ahead of Lysa's position, but obscured by the ranks of Eta 5 interceptors ahead of her and X-Wings ahead of them, a dark line appeared in the floor, then broadened into a yawning starfield. Lysa saw the X-Wings complete their power-up procedures, some of them activating repulsors and floating up a meter or two off the hangar floor. She felt a stab of irritation that the Jedi Squadron would be the first flyers off Daldana in this operation, but she forced it back. The burners of the Jedi X-Wings kicked in, and they launched forward, diving down into a starry black gap leading to space. A squat armored shuttle lumbered along in their wake.
Vibro Sword Squadron, launch!
On the bridge of Dodona, Admiral Klauskin stood near the bow viewports, taking in the view and trying to reconcile it with words his aide spoke to him. To starboard hung the world of Corellia, close by. They'd winked in and out of hyperspace on the night side, close enough that the planet blocked out the sun. The ships belonging to the operation had arrived pointed straight down at the planet and had executed a simultaneous maneuver to port, swinging into high orbit and hurtling toward the planet's sunlit side. To port cruised the dozens of capital craft belonging to his operation, cruisers, carriers, destroyers, frigates, and streaming from them were hundreds of starfighters and support vehicles. Every one of them cruised with running lights ablaze, down on Corellia. All eyes would be attracted to the gleaming beauty of the GA military, to the flowing formation whose very presence said, "Do not defy the most powerful authority in the galaxy." Klauskin tuned back into the words of his aide, Fiav Fenn, a female Sullustan. She was saying something about the accuracy of their arrival pattern, which had apparently been pleasingly within the parameters he had set down in the previous day's staff meeting. He gently shook his head and waved to brush the topic aside.
"Ground response?"
he asked. She paused as if to change gears.
"None so far."
"None?"
Klauskin frowned.
"How long since we dropped out of hyperspace?"
4 minutes, 38 seconds, she said. 39, 40, 41.
"Yes, yes,"
Klauskin blinked. The Corellian armed forces must be very sloppy not to have their first fighter squadrons off the ground after more than 4.5 minutes. Then, the other fleet winked into existence. He saw the flicker of green running lights in his left side peripheral vision, even as the bridge's threat alarms began howling. The Admiral spun to look and stood there, transfixed. Stretched thin as a veil, a formation of spacecraft now occupied space between Klauskin's formation and every reasonable exit path away from Corellia. It was on the same course as Klauskin's fleet. A higher orbit, its vehicles and vessels traveling much faster than Klauskin's in order to maintain the same relationship to the world below, and Klauskin's fleet in between. Klauskin finally regained control of his voice.
"Kill the alarms,"
he said, his voice to his own ears sounding weak.
"We already know they're here. Composition?"
"Working on it," his chief sensor operator said. "They have nothing in the size class of Dodona, but they have Strident-class star defenders and a large number of frigates, corvettes, patrol boats, gunships, and heavy transports. Mostly Corellian Engineering Corporation, of course,
They must have lifted every half-finished frame, every rusted hulk, and every pleasure boat in the system to have pulled this off.
Kloskin's unobtrusive aide, Fiov, decided to become more obtrusive, stepping up beside the Admiral.
Sir,
she whispered,
have you revised orders for the operation?
Revised orders?
Kloskin's mind went oddly blank as he considered that question. It was an unsettling feeling, especially in one for whom decisiveness had always been a career hallmark. Ah, that was the problem. Revised orders should be issued to enable his formation to accomplish its goals, despite the complication that the Corellian formation posed. But that was now impossible. The overriding goal of this operation was to use a show of force to induce fear, awe, and consternation in the Corellians. But he could not do that now. He had failed. Less than 5 minutes into his operation, he had failed. His thinking processes became attached to that notion and could not pull free of it.